All right. What else? Politics deals with a question of power, right? That's the introduction to empowerment. What is power? Very quickly, come on. All of you should know these two concepts. They're not that difficult. What is power? What are we talking about?
Having the capacity to impact public policy.
All right. So if we're talking about politics, politics is tied into the whole concept of power, right? And if we're talking about empowerment as a concept, we must have an understanding of the notion of what is power. Now, does power come in one form? Does it come in many different forms? Different forms. Back here. What forms? Give me examples of power. Either one of them.
Education.
Knowledge. All right. Knowledge. Okay. What else? Numbers of people, right? What else?
Social status.
Social status, position, right? If you're the chairperson of a major corporation, would you say that that person has some power?
Most definitely.
All right, especially if you're from IBM or General Motors or Chrysler Corporation.
I think it's like some examples, some gender and race can give you power.
Gender, race. All right, let's deal with that. All right, gender, race. Let's talk about race in terms of power. If I make the statement, which I did, that there's no fear factor when it comes to the Chicano Latino community, and there is much more of a fear factor in dealing with the African American community, am I now dealing with a racial factor of power?
Yes.
Why?
Because it's going to affect the decision-making process, the politics.
Right.
African Americans have been more organized and have had more leaders, or not more leaders, but who have more leaders who've been known or
more recognized.
Like more recognized.
All right.
I think that's a fear factor.
That is a part of the fear factor. I mean, if one looks at what Jesse Jackson is doing vis-a-vis who? The Major League? Baseball teams and all that? Football and all that? What's his underlying argument? What's his criticism? That they're not sufficient numbers of what?
Blacks.
Well, he says minorities. He's smart. He talks about minorities, but he's really talking about African Americans.
In the managerial process,
right?
Of professional sports.
Exactly. Managerial, owner, managers, etc., right? All right. Have you heard of a Latino say this? Or would a cloud that Jesse Jackson have said that about Latinos? No. We have. And we're going to get into that in our discussion. All right. So the whole notion of power is very important to understand, because here I am making some statements, all right? Some generalities that some people would say are not true. I mean, how can Dr. Navarro say that Latinos have no real power, no fear factor? After all, they have two people that are cabinet members. They have supervisor here in Los Angeles. They have city council people in Los Angeles, and yet he's saying that they have no power. Well, power is relative as well, right? It's relative. It's relational. Power is relational. How can you measure power? Power is impossible to measure, all right? In other words, you cannot break power apart into various ingredients and say A, B, C, D. These are the ingredients of power. We can make generalities. Position, wealth, all these different things that I've talked about. But power is difficult to measure. So that we must deal with the whole question of empowerment from also the perspective of potential power versus actual power. There is a difference. If I am, for example, the president of a major labor union or a major corporation, the position as president of that entity gives me so much power. But yet, if I do not know how to utilize that entity in terms of its mobilization for a given objective, like a labor union, if I have 14 million people as members and I don't show any manifestation of power, am I powerful? Well, it has to be measured by what you're trying to do, what the objectives are. Example, labor today is being challenged by perhaps one of the most serious pieces of not legislation per se, because it's not in a legislative form yet, but a proposed North American Free Trade Agreement that if passed by Congress is going to impact three economies, Canada, U.S., and Mexico. Labor as a sector is going to be the most impacted. How is labor today mobilizing its great power of not just the AFL-CIO and its 14 million members, but the United Auto Workers and many other labor organizations? What are they doing to influence public policy?
Combining power.
Huh?
They're combining their power.
How are they combining their power?
By aligning with other unions.
All right, they're forming coalitions among themselves. They're forming coalitions with who? Environmental groups, right? Because environment supposedly is going to be also negatively impacted, especially along the border. All right, so there's a lot of coalition building. But can you say as a historian that labor is doing what they were infamous for doing 30, 40 years ago, taking to the streets?
They've definitely lost power.
All right, good point. He said they have lost power. So your measurement of a loss of power is based on what?
What they can't get done.
All right, You don't see what you've read about, right?
Right.
Today, all right, that's one perception. Is the black community less powerful today in 1993 than it was in 1968 with the Poor People's March in Washington, or 1963 again on the march to Washington, on Washington, when Martin Luther King gave his famous speech, "I Have a Dream"? There were 300,000 people at that march in 1963. Which period of time, historically speaking, was a time where blacks were manifesting much more power? Today, 1963 or
1968? When?
When
manifesting beginning to get more power?
When, in comparison to 1993, 1968, 1963, during those three periods, when would you say blacks demonstrated much more power? They have more power? Why do you say that?
Because they're more recognized.
Does recognition give you power?
To some aspects, yeah. I think the problem with your question is a different sort of power.
Ah, very good. Explain that.
You have African Americans more institutionalized in our system now than they were in '68.
Right, stop right there. Today, they have how many congressmen? 38 congressional representatives. I don't know how many they had in 1963. I'm not even going to try to guess, but probably no more than two or three if they were lucky. All right, would you say that?
All right,
go on. What else?
In
'68,
the blacks were a whole lot more mobilized, much better mobilized. 300,000 marching on Washington, as an example. You probably couldn't get that today.
You know, Chicanos, the high point of the mobilization capability was 1970, during the era of the Vietnam War. 25,000 Chicanos were mobilized in Los Angeles at the National Chicano Moratorium against the war. No one has come even close, with the exception of the death of Cesar Chavez recently, where there were approximately 40,000 people, to mobilize large numbers of people into some kind of a effort or movement. So he's correct. It depends on the time, depends on the circumstances, and the form of power. Institutionalized power is different from the unconventional form that you just described. All right. Well, what I'm trying to get at is potential versus actual. My argument, simple as it is that Chicanos in 1993 are fast developing a high potential for power, but they're a long way from actualizing the true power. Okay? In other words, that we're still at the potential phase of our empowerment and not at the actual power phase. All right. Anything else on those two concepts? All right, let's get into discussion on voter participation, and these are kind of general comments. I don't have the time to give you a lot of statistics, but I'll give you some general trends, some statistical information that will prove a point that will introduce the subject of political participation in the United States. Now, in a democracy, The participation of the citizenry is imperative. It is absolutely imperative, if it's to be a democracy, to have the people participate. Now, what am I trying to say? It is imperative for the people to participate in the political process. Another way of saying it. What am I saying? But why is it important in a democracy for the people to participate? Still with the question. Not the methods.
Because if people don't vote, there'll be an elite group of the one monarchy that has control. Democracy.
What's a monarchy? Type of family, right? King, not elected, all right. Hereditary, etc., etc. All right. But what am I getting at? What's the essence of what I'm asking for? Yes, fire away.
By its very nature, democracy demands voting. Without voting.
Stop right there. You made a statement. By the very nature of democracy, what is a democracy?
Democracy is ruled by the people.
All right. Demos, kratos, right? People. Rule, another Greek word, the Greeks were major contributors to this political process of development concepts. Demos kratos, people govern or people rule. All right. We tell the world that democracy is what we practice. Is that correct? Is that what we tell the world? Yes? All right. Would you agree? What else do we say in selling our political system? In selling our political system, we make it synonymous by saying that we don't distinguish the form of economic system versus a political system, and that we put it in the same kennel. Democracy and capitalism are essentially the same. Are they the same? No, but yet we do. And if we listen carefully and read carefully, all these books on international relations, foreign relations, and so forth. What is it that we tell the world that America is? The cradle of democracy. We are the cradle of democracy. We are the bastion of the free world, etc., etc., etc. And when Ronald Reagan was in power, we talked about the evil empire, right? Categorizing the Soviet Union and the so-called communist empire as an evil empire. All right. I say this because there is a tendency for some of us to believe, because we have been conditioned, right? Who conditions us to think the way we think? What did we say earlier? Talking about culture.
We learned through
schools, right? Schools, the media, everything else. I mean, doesn't the media tell us that there's only a two-party system in this country? Why is it that the Communist Party, the Socialist Workers Party, the Prohibitionist Party, the American Independent Party, all these parties that we have, supposedly minority parties, don't get the same kind of treatment as the Democratic and Republican parties? They're not mainstream, right? We have a two-party system. We are taught from the very beginning that there's only two parties. That's a different subject, but the point I'm trying to make is that if we look into the realities of what we have as a political system, we tell the world that in this country democracy is very much alive, because we have a Congress, we have a Supreme Court, we have a presidency. We have a political system that is governed by certain principles and laws that emanate from what? The Constitution, which is a living document. The Constitution, right? That is very much the document that protects, conceptually and otherwise, our way of life, our democracy, and so forth. Well, if we remember our Chicano history, my point as we get into the whole question of Chicano political participation is that it's difficult for us as Chicanos, as we get into it, to understand why is it, including ourselves, because a lot of Chicanos don't even understand why we don't vote, why don't we participate, and they come up with all kinds of somewhat superficial analysis, that much of our political behavior is a product of what was covered in this class under history and culture. And what did I say? Two major currents of history, two major currents of political culture, right? And what is political culture? I'll get back to that concept, but just general terms. What is political culture? What is political culture? All right. I want you to think, put that concept down, because you're gonna hear about it in the next few minutes. It's very important that you understand that concept, political culture. But one thing I want to underline here is that we are products of a historical, dualistic process, Mexico's history, U.S. history. We're products of what? A cultural process that's also Mexican and American, whatever American means, all right? So those two major ingredients have molded the rationale that I'm using in this class to explain why is it that we're still at the potential phase of empowerment and we still have a long ways to go before we realize that concept that I described called empowerment. But before we get into that substance of that, is that I want to just briefly cover that even though I'm saying that Chicanos do not vote in great numbers, that we don't participate in many organizations in great numbers, the fact is, as I mentioned earlier, that even though we tell the world we are the beacon of light, of freedom, of liberty, justice, and all these different things, by and large, not a lot of people participate politically across the board. I don't care if you're African American, I don't care if you're Asian American, I don't care if you're Latino or whatever. Most Americans do not vote in great numbers. So it's a double whammy introducing the subject matter here. Americans, in comparison to Great Britain, in comparison to France, in comparison to Germany, in comparison to Italy, we don't vote in the numbers that they do. Right? I mean, if we had more time, I could give you statistic after statistic. Italy, for example, has a voter turnout of 90% of those that are eligible to vote. We're lucky we get 50%. Are we less democratic? Are they more democratic? Why is it that Italy has a much larger, a higher voter level of participation? Or Germany? Or even Canada? 70%. The fact is, the democracy in this country is dying. I want you to put that down, because it's going to be important, at least for my analysis. I don't want you to agree or disagree at this point. Just write it down. You have plenty of time, 1 week to think about it. American democracy is dying. I want you to put that whole phrase in black and white. American democracy is dying. And I want you to try to think of why as we get into the discussion on Chicano participation. And we'll get back to that statement next week. So, for us, as Chicanos, is a double jeopardy. That's another point I want to underscore. Because if the larger general population doesn't vote in great numbers, when you're at the bottom of the political, socioeconomic totem pole, you're at the bottom. You're at the very bottom. With all the problems of poverty and all the social problems that we've been talking about, it's understandable why, perhaps, Chicanos do not vote or participate in great numbers. Now, the literature in political science dealing with factors influencing voting are many. Are many. Civic culture, Alma Verba, 1972 or so, is one book that you can look at. There's a book by Raymond Wolfinger, Stephen Ronstone, Who Votes? That's another book. And the literature goes on and on. But all I want to do in terms of just giving you some idea of what are the factors that influence people's participation in the political process in this country. And there are essentially five. You can probably develop more, but these are general categories. Most of the literature of political science, and I think Mr. Verba would agree with me on this, that People tend to vote because they have a sense of duty. What does that mean? A sense of duty. They regard participation as important. Now, why would you say that this is a factor that influences voting? Now, this is a very somewhat altruistic value, right? A sense of duty. Why? Why would you say that people in this country have, some people have vote because they have a sense of duty? Why? Right here.
I don't know, probably it stems mostly from your education and your childhood when you're told you're an American citizen and it's your civic duty, you know, towards other people and, you know, getting the government going to vote and put your two cents in. Because without you, then we won't have government. Same sense of jury duty, too.
Okay. Jury. Good point. Duty. As we go through some of these five, I want you to think of the agents of socialization. Because then I want you to think, as we get into the discussion on Chicanos, how do those agents affect us as Chicanos, right? Number one, sense of duty. Who is responsible for inculcating that sense of duty? One, the family, right? Remember, the family is your primary agent. Two, the educational institutions. I mean, from the time that you start kindergarten to the time that you graduate from a university, it's constant, not constant, but somewhat of a consistent bombardment of values, attitudes, etc., reinforcing the nature of the political system and the virtues of participating in the political process. So in essence, what I'm saying is you acquire this through the socialization process that we've discussed already. Yes, sir?
I think that it's more eye-opening to see that this doesn't exist more than it does, and that's why people don't vote. It seems that, I mean, you talk to people, they have an attitude, I can't make a difference. That's why I don't vote. It's not my responsibility. That's why I don't vote. There's not a sense of duty, even though, like you said, from the beginning, supposedly we're getting it all through school.
Why do you suppose that has changed? And this is a much of a recent phenomenon, much more. Because you've had declining voter participation levels since the 1970s. I'm giving you the answer. What has been the problem? Contributing to what you just said.
Well, I agree with what you were saying, but I think maybe one of the reasons could be they're not being represented. They don't think they're being represented. They don't simulate direct results for them, you know, coming out of, like, mm-hmm. the representation of the government who's in control.
Okay.
I mean, you know, a lot of people...
Would you agree with that?
They vote their pocketbook. They
vote definitely their pocketbook, right? That's true. What would you add to?
Well, you say we're not represented, it's like they say there's not much choice between, say, like the last, we voted for Clinton or,
Bush. Bush.
I don't think there's much trust.
Trust
in the system.
Why?
More corruption.
Why?
You had Nixon.
What did you have in the 70s? Now, let's talk about that. What did we have?
Well, in the beginning, well, even in the late 60s, you had Vietnam.
Go ahead. Excellent. What did Vietnam do?
Turned the youth, especially, against the government policies, the educated youth, more so. And those were, I think, the people that were going to be voting as they went on. They lost faith in the system. They lost faith in their leaders.
All right. On that score, would you say that most of you, without getting personal here, are products in terms of birth of the 60s? All of you were born in the 60s, early 70s, right? So that means that most of your parents were very much part of the era of the 60s, right? All right, would you say, go back to you, that your parents were very much influenced by the Vietnam War, one way or the other?
Yeah.
Which way? Which direction?
Total apathy.
Total apathy.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, my mom, total apathy. I think she just got burned out. She got sick and tired of, you know, turning on the news and seeing another corrupt man or another scandal breaking out. She knew friends that were dying in Vietnam. You know, she had friends that were drafted, were sent, were dying, and she didn't believe in the system, and she just didn't care anymore. Okay. There was just a lot of negatives that built up, and she just let it go.
Okay, how about you? How about your parents?
My dad was drafted.
He was in was in the military during that time.
He was in the military at the time. Yeah. Okay. My mom claimed she was too young. She knew it. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know how my dad really felt about it. I know we come from a long line of military men, so he kind of felt a sense of duty. So.
Was there a sense of betrayal? Who else? Who else wants to share something here? What I'm trying to say.
I don't know.